Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome our guest co-host today, Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Welcome to Your Health, Laura.
Thank you.
You know, it's great to have you on the show. I know you're really interested in preventive medicine, surgery, outcomes of care, research, lots of issues.
Yeah, lots of exciting things happening. I think more and more people are starting to realize the importance of preventive medicine and keeping our patients healthy before they end up in our hospitals.
Well, we're going to have a great chance today to talk about some public health when we talk with Boston University School of Medicine author and physician Dr. Megan Sandel about why access to affordable housing is a vaccine important for good health. I think that you will believe that already.
I am in full support of the work that she's doing.
Well, we'll look forward to the conversation. But first, we have some interesting research that matters. And let's just dive in there. And our first research that matters is about Alzheimer's. I bet you've seen people with Alzheimer's before, maybe even have family members like I do.
I have. You know, it's a really tough disease. I myself had a grandmother with Alzheimer's disease, and I think it's hard for patients to see someone that they love no longer be able to remember them or have personality changes. It's a tough disorder.
Yeah. My mother passed away earlier this year and had some vascular dementia, and it was just really hard to see the memories sometimes not be there. And we were always looking for tricks or tools that could retrieve a memory, could stimulate a memory, whether it was a picture or, in a lot of cases with my mother, the sound of music, which she loved and I did as well, and we could watch it and retrieve. And this research is about with people with Alzheimer's, well, actually in mice with Alzheimer's to be particular, that maybe that memories can be retrieved. What's this about?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting article supported by the NIH and came out of Columbia University. Essentially, what these researchers found is that our traditional thinking of Alzheimer's disease is that the memories are actually destroyed. But what they found in these mice are that those memories are still present, and they were able to stimulate the cells in these mice's brains and actually have the mice retrieve memories.
Yeah, it almost sounds a little bit like kind of science fiction, but they had these mice that some of whom were healthy, some of whom had Alzheimer's, and they learned to associate a lemon smell, unfortunately with a mild electric shock, a bad thing. And they found that the Alzheimer's disease mice, they could record that they had had this lemon scent, but they couldn't associate it with this kind of negative aspect, but the normal mouse could. But the idea was that they could, with a bright laser light, they could re-stimulate and recall this memory that was stored. Now, I don't think we can do that because we don't have the genetic engineering for these laser lights to bring back. But I think this implies certain things.
Yeah, correct. I mean, I think it shifts the entire paradigm of how we think about Alzheimer's disease. And although we don't currently have the technology to bring this to humans for treatment, it does imply that this is something that we could start to think about down the road. For example, using deep brain stimulation to trigger those memories that have been lost.
Yeah, I love it because it suggests that maybe the way we've thought about something may not be right, that Alzheimer's destroys memory, that people can't regain it, but perhaps they can. Certainly, it's easier to prevent Alzheimer's than to treat it. But boy, wouldn't it be something to be able to bring back a memory. And we see that sometimes with people with Alzheimer's that you think they've lost. And then all of a sudden, I had an aunt who had Alzheimer's, and long past the place where she thought people can remember, she would looked at me one time and said, "Adam, so nice to see you." You know, it's like everyone just looked at me like, I said, I don't know where that came from.
Yeah. And our current understanding now, I think we aren't exactly sure why those memories sometimes are recalled. There is some evidence to suggest sometimes it might be associated with strong smells or music, like you mentioned, with your mother. But I think that we don't have a great understanding. However, this study certainly gives us places to move in the future.
Yeah, we don't want to, though, do this research with humans. And when they smell lemons, they get an electric shock. We'll have to come up with a different way of doing it. Let's talk about the next research that matters. Really interesting research about pesticides and pesticides on fruit and vegetables, and can this be linked with more difficulties getting pregnant?
Yeah, excellent research question. So this is a study that was published in JAMA Internal Medicine recently. And it's important to note that all of these women were having issues getting pregnant on their own. So all of them were seeking assistance with in vitro fertilization. And then the researchers asked some specific questions about diet, age, weight, and history of pregnancies prior to figure out what things might be associated with successful IVF and non-successful IVF.
Yeah, the in vitro fertilization. These researchers at Harvard School of Public Health, they were really assessing kind of the fruits and vegetables that sometimes are very high in pesticide use, things like strawberries, spinach, peppers, things that are, the fruit is in direct contact potentially with pesticides, versus things like avocados or peas that are maybe in shells that maybe have some protective coating. So even if pesticides are used, lower link. What did they find?
So what they found is some indirect evidence that women who consumed more of these fruits and vegetables, like strawberries you mentioned, that are associated with high pesticide use, these women had lower success rates with IVF compared to women who didn't eat these high pesticide fruit and vegetables.
Yeah, they're 18% less likely to get pregnant with the highest compared to the lowest exposure, and 26% less likely to have a live birth. Now, we will be the first to say this is not cause and effect. This is an association. But boy, it gets my attention.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's one of the important things to point out. Like you mentioned, we can't determine causality here. So, you know, we aren't directly measuring the amount of pesticides that the women are ingesting. We're not doing tests on the women themselves to look at byproducts in their blood or in their urine. But that being said, this is certainly an interesting association, and I think there will be more interest in this in the future.
You know, one of my take-home messages, if possible, eat organic. That would be the low pesticide. And if you substitute a low pesticide or no pesticide, you have like almost an 80% higher odds of pregnancy and of a live birth. That's research that I can take home. And the next one's about alcohol and marijuana use in teens. As we've seen some improvement in alcohol use and reductions among teens, we've also seen some really loosening and liberalization of marijuana laws around the country. And there is an association with those laws being loosened and increased marijuana use by teens. And this research may suggest there's a little problem here.
Yeah, so this is a really powerful study. This is data that was collected on nearly 1,200 individuals starting at age 12 and then followed until they were in their late 20s and early 30s. So quite powerful data on a number of individuals across the United States and following them for, in some cases, 10 to 20 years. What this study found was that those individuals who in their teen years used marijuana and alcohol heavily, they tended to have less success later in life by what we would call normal adulthood milestones.
Yeah, across all sorts of measures, they were less likely to obtain a college degree, had lower social kind of advancement, and maybe they were equally likely to get married or get employment. But it did suggest that particularly dependent use in adolescence affects people for long periods, maybe their lifetime. I think this is important. Parents need to understand this, and I think policymakers need to hear this message too. It's not just that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, it's certainly very relevant for what's happening in the United States today as more and more states are legalizing marijuana. So I'll be interested to hear what happens as they continue to follow these individuals.
Let's talk really briefly about our last research that matters. And it's about this Streptococcus group B bacteria that's a common cause of really infection in people. We think about it a lot of times in pregnancy where we screen for it, and in the newborn where we hope that the children don't get it. We give antibiotics a lot of the time, but they're talking about maybe there could be development of a vaccination.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the important thing to know here is that this is a very common bacteria, as you mentioned. One in five women have this, and it can not only cause harm to the fetus when the mother is pregnant, but to the newborn as well. In the United States and in other developed countries, as you mentioned, we screen for this, and if positive, we treat the mom with antibiotics so that she doesn't pass it on to the fetus or newborn. But in developing countries, they don't have the resources and utilities to be able to do this neonatal screening. And so development of a vaccination could really help to bring down stillbirth and newborn death rates in developing countries.
Yeah, could it possibly impact hundreds of thousands of people around the world? Well, that's hopefully the pre-research that matters, but we're really looking forward to maybe some progress in this area. That'll conclude this portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, Laura and I will be talking with Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Public Health at Boston University School of Medicine Public Health, Dr. Megan Sandel, about why access to affordable housing is a vaccine important for good health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Today on Conversations, Laura, we're talking with Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Public Health at Boston University School of Medicine and Public Health, Dr. Megan Sandel, about why access to affordable housing is a vaccine important for good health. Welcome, Dr. Sandel.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
You know, let's just start out. How did you ever get interested in both being a physician and also public health and then housing?
So I think that I decided to become a doctor for somewhat the usual reasons. I wanted to help people, and I felt like being a doctor was a really good way to start. And when I had graduated from medical school, I'd started my pediatric residency in Boston at what was then called Boston City Hospital, now Boston Medical Center. And I admitted a child to the intensive care unit with a really severe asthma attack. And what happened was I was kind of tearing my hair out trying to figure out, why did this kid come to the ICU? She had had really pretty well-controlled asthma. And I ended up asking the family kind of a fateful question. I asked them what had changed. And they basically said that they'd gotten a cat. And I was pretty mystified. I had seen in the chart that she was supposed to be allergic to cats. And so I asked them why they got the cat. And they ended up talking about finding mouse droppings in the child's bed. And they felt really that they couldn't get rid of the mice. They had talked to their landlord hadn't really made any changes. And so they got a cat to get rid of the mice. And that was probably the reason why she ended up in the ICU. And for me, it was that eureka moment where I said, I felt like I couldn't send her home without necessarily it being healthy. And so what the prescription I wanted to write was for a healthy home, and that wasn't stocked at the pharmacy at Boston City Hospital at the time. And so it made me want to really embark on what a healthy housing prescription would look like and ways in which we could make that happen.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that with us. You've written a lot. In March, you wrote an article where you did mention that perhaps Dr. Ben Carson could write a prescription for housing. And you've also referred to affordable housings as vaccines. Could you tell us a little bit more what you mean about that?
Yeah, I think that when we think about vaccines, like, why do we think that they're really good for your health? And a lot of it has to do with, I think, both individual protection, right? It helps you have some immunity or resilience against multiple threats. And then it also is really good from a community perspective, right? If you have a lot of people vaccinated, you have kind of herd immunity. It kind of protects everyone in the community from disease and potentially being healthier. And so I think of kind of a stable, decent, affordable home can act as a vaccine for a couple of reasons. First is from kind of an immunity, individual protection perspective. We did some research with a research policy network called Children's Health Watch, where we looked at a high-risk group, families that were food insecure. And we looked at kids in families that were food insecure and were receiving a housing subsidy, so only had to spend, say, 30% of their income on housing, or the families that were food insecure eligible for that housing subsidy but not receiving it. And what we saw was the families of kids that were food insecure but having a housing subsidy were twofold less likely to be stunted in their growth. if they had that housing subsidy. So that's where I think of it as acting like a vaccine. You have a threat to your health, which is food insecurity, making you more likely to be underweight. And yet the housing subsidy protected you against being underweight. But I also think that where we think about community investment for vaccines, I use the example of the varicella vaccine or chickenpox vaccine. And that's where when you look at actually the cost benefit of varicella vaccine, it actually costs you money. It costs about $2 for every case that you prevent. So it actually doesn't save money purely on a healthcare cost perspective. But when you look at the societal return of a chickenpox vaccine, for every dollar you spend on that varicella vaccine, you actually get $5 back societally. And so for that reason, we vaccinate against chickenpox, not just to prevent cases, but to help parents stay at work so their kids don't get sick. And that is where I think of kind of a stable, affordable home can be that vaccine, not just for the individual protection, but also societally to keep parents working, to keep kids in school, to keep people thriving.
I'm thinking to my own experience as a family physician and patients, one of whom would walk 6 miles to see me from his outdoor shed, and how much I knew that it was so difficult for every aspect of his healthcare because he didn't have housing. And another situation where a patient of mine would be homeless, but they're living with their daughter and son-in-law, but the daughter and son-in-law smoke 2 packs a day and they're not willing to smoke outside the house, and she's got severe asthma. And so it's not just always about someone who's homeless, but not having a stable housing. Is that common?
Yeah, I think that you don't necessarily think about this housing crisis beyond homelessness, right? We typically just focus on the homeless population that we can see, and we don't often, I say, look below the surface. So if you think about kind of housing stability as almost kind of an iceberg, homelessness is the part you can see. There's a lot of iceberg below the surface. And so I tend to think about kind of how housing impacts health as multidimensional. So there's really stability, which is really important. And it's not just that you say aren't homeless, but that you're stable, you're not moving frequently. But I think it also has to do with a quality home, right? So you're not having things like, you know, smoke or pests or molds or other types of things. And it also needs to be affordable. If you're choosing between rent and eating, that's not a healthy home either. I think as you think about kind of a quality, stable, decent home, I think you also need to think about it being in a neighborhood of location or a community that has opportunity. So it has jobs, it has healthy food, it has places to exercise. And so if you think about kind of stable, decent, affordable in a community of opportunity, those four components are really what's needed to be healthy.
Can you give us an idea of how widespread this problem is? How many people does inadequate housing impact?
Yeah, I think that we're really talking about millions of individuals and families across the country. So if we kind of take each of those pieces of what's needed to be kind of a healthy home, so it's estimated about 6 million households have housing quality problems. Somewhere between 500,000 to 600,000 people are homeless on any given night, and somewhere between 2.8 to 2.9 million people are at risk of eviction because they're, say, falling behind on their rent or other things. And then there are a lot of families that are just cost burdened. So almost 11 million families are spending close to half of their take-home income on rent, which places them at severe risk of having to choose between, are they going to pay for medicine? Are they going to pay for food? Are they going to pay for heat? Or are they going to pay for the rent bill? And so we're really talking about tens of millions of people that are in need of that kind of housing vaccine. And yet we know that the current kind of availability is only 1 out of 4 eligible people are actually able to access something that gets them that stable, decent, affordable home.
You know, we're going to really explore lots of dimensions of this issue, including what we can do about it and what's working. But we're going to take a short break. We're talking with Dr. Megan Sandel about why access to affordable housing is a vaccine important for good health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Public Health at Boston University School of Medicine, Dr. Megan Sandel, about why access to affordable housing is a vaccine for good health. And, you know, right before the break, Dr. Sandel, you were really making the case for how widespread this issue is and why the analogy to vaccines really works. I wonder how easy has that been a sell, not to our patients who really get this better than perhaps most doctors, because most doctors don't have kind of unstable housing, but to your colleagues. Has this been an easy sell throughout the years to your colleagues at Boston University and around the country?
Yeah, I think that oftentimes we as physicians don't like to bring up subjects where we don't know the answers to the questions, right? And so to an extent, just being able to start to ask questions about people's housing situations, we get an answer and then we don't know what to do with it, can be extremely frustrating. My colleagues in a research policy network called Children's Health Watch, we started something called the Hunger Vital Sign about 6 or 7 years ago, trying to arm people with just the simple 2 questions you can ask in your office setting to uncover whether somebody's food insecure, and then being able to link with different resources to address it. We recently started piloting a housing stability vital sign, similar, like 3 questions you can ask to uncover if somebody has a history of homelessness, is moving frequently, or is falling behind on rent, in order to identify that at-risk population. And about 1 in 3 of the low-income renter families that we encountered have at least one form of housing instability. I think that one of the things has been trying to encourage people to ask those questions. Even if you don't have an answer right away, that becomes important information for your hospital, for your health system to understand, because those are really high-risk patients. And while we may not have a response now, are there ways in which we can develop responses in the future?
So you mentioned that you have some really great programs in the works. I'm wondering, how did you convince either your hospital or your health system these types of partnerships were necessary, or are you more so partnering with community agencies to get this movement going?
Yeah, I think of this as, if we're going to need housing prescriptions and we need to kind of stock that housing pharmacy, that really is something that's going to be an alignment of different partnerships and really an alignment of different dollars. And so as we think about kind of the healthcare dollar, we pay for a lot of services, and we pay for visiting nurses, or we pay for community health workers or other case managers. But a lot of them may not have the expertise in around housing. And so being able to partner with community agencies that understand housing search, understand how to certify someone for housing or a housing subsidy, being able to work with housing agencies where they may be able to create special access for high-risk families or others. And so we started piloting a program called Housing Prescriptions as Healthcare, where we're identifying families where someone in the household is using a lot of healthcare, at least 3 ED visits in a year, and yet is housing unstable but not homeless yet. And we're trying to dive in with the multidisciplinary team, the healthcare team, with a housing case manager, and with sometimes access to a lawyer if they need that, or with a financial coach to try and help them. And the coup has been is that our local public housing authority has been willing to put some units on the table for those that are at the highest risk and really need that unit in order to be stabilized. And I think more and more of these partnerships are going to become the norm, where we're going to be able to partner social service, housing agencies, and healthcare, where we can align our dollars to be really synergistic to help families earlier.
I love your optimism. It's really wonderful. I mean, we have social workers embedded in our patient-centered medical homes now, and we approach them with all kinds of issues. And sometimes we really can't solve them. Sometimes we can just link them with community agencies. But you're not saying that they can't try innovation. And it sounds like you're trying to create these networks. I can imagine if, for instance, Medicare finds, which I suspect there is research, that you're more likely to get readmitted to the hospital after surgery if you go to unstable housing. That seems like a no-brainer. That we wouldn't penalize the hospital, but we'd say you have to at least make an effort to ensure more stability when you go home.
Yeah, I think the reality is right now we're pretty inefficient with some of our resources. And so I think there are ways in which we can be more efficient. I think the reality is we do need more resources, though. Like, the housing budgets have been actually going down as the need has been going up. And I think that that's where we as physicians can be really important voices in this debate, that really investing in, you know, affordable homes in every community is going to be good for everyone, not just the people that are housed, but actually how that affects the market. It potentially makes other affordable housing more affordable, and it also potentially makes your schools work better, your jobs work better, your healthcare work better. There's nothing more frustrating than being a doctor where your patient can't focus on their chronic disease because they're just worried about where they're going to sleep that night. And so if there are ways in which we can start to take that worry off their plate, then they can take care of their health, and that's ultimately better for everyone.
Absolutely. You know, I know in my previous training, I was in surgery in Atlanta and had sort of the same thought that a lot of my patients were coming in for operations, but then as soon as I discharged them, didn't have the resources to take care of themselves. And so for other physicians out there who may not know where to turn, how can they get involved in matters like these, or how can they find out if a similar efforts are happening in their communities?
One of the biggest things that they can do, honestly, is by starting to potentially even ask patients and collect data. I think that it was really shocking to our hospital when we did a simple inpatient survey. So we surveyed over a week everyone that was inpatient at our hospital and found that 25% of the people who are hospitalized were homeless, right? And so when we looked particularly at the high-risk patients, the patients we knew were at risk of readmissions, if they were homeless, they were 70% more likely to come back and be rehospitalized within 30 days. And so just that simple piece of information motivated the hospital to say, oh, okay, we need a housing support program. If we're not in the housing support program business, we are going to lose a lot of money under our value-based contracts. And so simply first getting a sense of the scope of the problem, I know it sounds frustrating, but it actually opens up doors. I think the second is really getting to know your housing community. They're thirsting to have outlets with different healthcare agencies, and they have no idea how to crack that. So I've encouraged housing agencies to get doctors or nurses to be on their boards, to actually help them understand the healthcare system, how they can interact, because oftentimes you have a case manager who's at the hospital trying to find a patient when the on-site resident service coordinator at that building sees that patient every day. And if they knew how to interact with the healthcare system, they could actually have a piece of their resident coordinator paid for just to keep track of high-risk patients. And so those are kind of two simple ways in which I think they can start to learn more and be able to just get their hospital more motivated to invest in these areas.
You know, I've been struck several times when I'm attending on our inpatient service taking care of complex patients that occasionally we'll have a patient who's been in the hospital for 3 months, 6 months, because they have nowhere to go. And the cost could be $500,000, $2 million. Yeah. And it seems like that should no longer occur.
Yeah, I think where I find it kind of baffling is that the feeling that we can't do anything about it, right? And so what I find mind-boggling is, right, we talk all the time about genetics and precision medicine and how we're going to, you know, design special tailored medicines based on your genes, when, like, a simple thing like a home may be the most powerful intervention that we can supply for someone. And I think that's where we have to change from this, like, well, we can't do anything about this, to being like, well, we have to do something about this. Like, this is craziness. And I definitely think that there are ways in which we can think through housing support programs as a cost-effective intervention for our patients.
Absolutely. Dr. Sandell, it's been a pleasure and a really powerful conversation that we've had here today. Is there a final thought you would like to leave our listeners with as we wrap up?
Yeah, I think that when we think about physicians and how our healthcare system works, I think we're familiar with certain concepts. Like, there are hospitals that they're nonprofits, have community benefit obligations, and with that they have to do a certain amount of giving in the community, or that there are certain things that are paid for by insurance or provider type of dollars. What I really encourage doctors to learn more about is how their hospital systems are potentially investing right now, because many hospitals and healthcare systems have endowments that they're doing investments, but they're just not thinking of them as social impact investors. And I really encourage us all to educate ourselves about how is our hospital investing money, and are there ways in which way they could have a double bottom line in mind, something that both helps the community but also helps us do things like house our patients.
Wow, that sounds amazing. We really want to thank Dr. Megan Sandel for being our guest today on Your Health. And we're going to put your really important article that I think you've talked to, we've talked around the margins for, but you had a great article in the Journal of the American Medical Association about investing in housing for health improves both mission and margin and is the right thing to do. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Adam. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laura and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone who has experienced loss.
My uncle recently passed away and my aunt is grieving. What should we expect, and how can we help her through this difficult time as healthily as possible?
I like that word, healthily.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it.
Yeah, because it's not easy. But, you know, it's interesting. Doctors, we see a lot of people who pass away. That's our field. But at the same token, it's different than when you experience it personally. I mean, having lost my mother not too long ago, it's different than when you take care of someone whose mother passed away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we know about death and grief are that there are five stages that are pretty common that most people will experience. And some of you listeners out there may be familiar with this already, but the first is called denial, which is where you're really having a hard time struggling to believe that you even lost your loved one. The second is anger, and then bargaining. Next is depression, which is when you really start to have feelings of sadness. You may be wanting to lie in bed all day crying. And then finally, you move on to acceptance. Now, that's not to say that you ever forget that loved one, but you sort of have come to terms with the loss.
Yeah, and I think we can ask actually our great health science librarians to maybe put Dr. Kubler-Ross's stages of kind of dealing with death up there. And not everyone goes through all stages, and it's not necessarily always sequential. You may, for someone who's suffered for a long time, there may be relief, which could stimulate guilt and then all kinds of other issues, versus someone who's taken away suddenly could really cause some anger and other kinds of feelings. But it's a complicated process. I happen to think that grieving and loss works best when one can talk about it and be in a community that can be supportive. And a lot of times I think faith communities are really pretty supportive out there, because a lot of times people look at you and you look the same, but you're not the same person.
Yeah, absolutely. I think finding support in whatever form you can is essential to helping to deal with grief in a healthy way. If you have family that you're able to talk to and can lean on, that's a great resource for support. Faith-based is another great resource. And support groups for people who have lost individuals in a similar fashion can also be a great resource.
Thank you for that very question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm preparing for a hip replacement, and the doctor says that she plans to give me a prescription opioid to help with pain in the week or so following the surgery. I've heard such horrible news about the opioid epidemic. What's the safe way to take it?
Well, I know, Laura, that you did a number of years of surgery, and perhaps you participated, at least in medical school residency, in hip replacements. How did you oftentimes approach people who would be in substantial pain after surgery?
Yeah, I think this is a really excellent question, and certainly relevant to what's happening today across the United States. I think the first thing that's important to point out here is the difference between acute and chronic pain. And so a lot of the opioid epidemic that you hear about in the media refers to patients who are using opioids for chronic pain and have become dependent on them. Now, that being said, using opioids for an acute source of pain like a surgery is one of the acceptable ways to use opioids. Ideally, after an acute source of pain like surgery, you would only need to use opioids for 3 to 4 days. So you might ask your surgeon to only prescribe you for a few days without any refills. Another thing that you might consider if you're really concerned about taking opioids is asking for an alternative source of pain management like NSAIDs.
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents like ibuprofen, Aleve, Advil, Metoprin, Nuprin, those sorts of things.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think those are great ideas. Even sometimes doing some kind of work before surgery, like we call that kind of almost like hypnosis and suggestive that you will be in less pain and get up and moving and don't be laying in bed. The more you move, the quicker you'll actually be able to better handle that pain. But yeah, if the doctor gives you like, you know, 60 tablets to take home, maybe ask for less. you take that much home and you use it for several weeks, you're more likely to be addicted. So great suggestions, maybe even just plain Tylenol. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My daughter is 13 years old and has started making disparaging comments about her weight. I think her weight is perfectly healthy and want to instill good habits and a positive body image. Do you have any advice? And also, at what point should I worry?
I think that this is a difficult issue, really, in our society because the images and cues all around are one that thin is the way to be and healthy is perhaps less often discussed.
Yeah, you're right. This is a really tough question, especially when teenagers are facing a lot of pressure from the media and wanting to look like celebrities, wanting to look like the girls in magazines. My personal philosophy is one of the best things you can do as a parent is model good behavior yourself. And so that means not making negative comments about yourself, speaking about yourself in a positive light, because at this point, your daughter is probably looking most to you to see how you treat your own body.
And also, I'd find out where she's hearing these disparaging comments. Is she getting bullied in school or class? Maybe I've seen in some circumstances, unfortunately, I've seen a grandfather kind of bully a granddaughter calling them fat. And they may be overweight. They may even be obese. But I think this labeling and this bullying really causes disturbed body images. And that's a huge problem. So I think opening up the conversation and telling her, you think she looks great. You think she looks healthy. Those are great things to say.
Yeah.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
With doctors offering new technology, I'm wondering if it's okay somehow to just send my doctor a picture of my rash rather than actually making an appointment.
Like that's not happening already. I can't say how often we get texts now. There's so many different ways of getting in touch with your doctor, and I like that. I think that's really good to have access to the physician in so many different ways, by email, by phone, and sometimes by text when it's appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this can be a great way. If it's something that can easily be managed without an appointment, this is a great way to get in contact with your physician or a physician's assistant, even a nurse, to get information on how to treat it if an appointment isn't necessary.
The problem is it oftentimes requires, I mean, I saw a rash recently from a patient, but I had to ask like 10 follow-up questions. So we were texting back and forth, and we came up with a treatment plan, but the problem was I couldn't do any laboratory testing. I spent about 15 minutes and then another 5 minutes the next day on follow-up. The patient really did well, but then should we say up front that we have a policy that we should charge for our time and expertise? Because, you know, we wouldn't expect to get free advice anywhere and every time. So I think being upfront and transparent, but it really was convenient for the patient. And ultimately, the patient did really well.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. So not only how do we make sure that time is being used appropriately, but how do we document encounters like that? Can we put pictures and text conversations into the medical records? And at least currently, the answer is no.
Not as easy. We're getting better at it and making it secure as well. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health, and you can really email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu, and send us any question. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Co-host today, Dr. Laura Higginbotham, and our guest today, Dr. Megan Sandel. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Laura Higginbotham.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.